Jane Austen's celebrated novel Pride and Prejudice turns 200 this month, so we're taking the hour to celebrate Austen, her influence, and her delicious, sharply observed writing, which continues to leave its mark on the literary world today. Good morning, I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And here to talk Austen with us this hour is Paula Byrne, the author of The Real Jane Austen, A Life in Small Things. And we'd love to hear from you this hour. What is your favorite Jane Austen book? What do you think about Pride and Prejudice? And how about her big, saucy heroine, Elizabeth Bennet? And we also want to know why you think Austen's writing is still so important to so many people 200 years after she wrote, for instance, Pride and Prejudice. Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And Paula Byrne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So Pride and Prejudice, it's 200 today. That must be a big day for a Jane Austen biographer.
It is. It really is. I wrote the book really to coincide with the anniversary, although I've been thinking about the book for 10 years, so it's a culmination of 10 years thinking.
Is this your favorite Jane Austen?
I don't think it is, actually. I mean, I love it, and I think it's her most perfect work. It's almost too perfect, Pride and Prejudice, and she herself said it was too bright, light, and sparkling, and I know she's being ironic when she says that, because she knows that it's wonderful and it's perfect, but I think I like the more complex, slightly darker novels such as Mansfield Park. But I still, I mean, who couldn't love Elizabeth Bennet? We all love Elizabeth Bennet, and we all love Darcy, so I still love it, but it's not my absolute favorite.
Okay, well, we'll celebrate anyway. Maybe you can start a big Mansfield Park celebration for next time around. So what is it about, you know, Pride and Prejudice? This is, even though it's not your favorite, this is, I think, widely regarded as her most important or best novel. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting because who knows what the answer to that is, but it's interesting that when she had written the novel, she actually took down the opinions of her nearest and dearest. And it's quite interesting that they all thought Pride and Prejudice was the best. As a whole, they loved Elizabeth and they loved Mr. Darcy. So it seems that we're still having the same conversations. We're still talking about the characters. The characters are marvelous. Elizabeth Bennet, she was quite a new heroine. She was very feisty. So I think Austen was doing something very pioneering, very witty. So I think, as I say, it was popular with her family and friends, and it's still popular today. And it's got this wonderful Cinderella theme. I mean, let's not forget, Elizabeth she doesn't have status, she doesn't have money, she doesn't have connections, and yet she gets to marry this rich, wealthy man who adores her. What's not to love?
Well, one thing you can say is that Jane Austen's works, they definitely have legs. You know, they have been adapted to film, they have had Hollywood remakes starring people like Keira Knightley and Gwyneth Paltrow and Kate Winslet, and people love them. People keep going back to them. And here, let's just sample just one of these kind of recent redos of Jane Austen.
I have struggled in vain and I can bear it no longer. These past months have been a torment. I came to Rosings with the single object of seeing you. I had to see you. I have fought against my better judgment, my family's expectation, the inferiority of your birth, my rank and circumstance, all these things, and I'm willing to put them aside and ask you to end my agony.
I don't understand.
I love you.
I love the inferiority of your rank. It's fantastic.
I know. You don't hear that so much these days in courtships.
No, you don't. But, you know, what's so interesting about the courtship novel, which is essentially what Jane Austen was writing, was that, you know, marriage was a contract. It was what women did. You know, women didn't have jobs and they didn't have careers. And sort of making a good match was actually something that most heroines want to do. So she's working within the confines of that genre. And that's why it is just so, it's radical and extraordinary and bold and brave that she has this heroine who does not have wealth and status. We're not even told that she's particularly beautiful. She has fine eyes. What she does have is this fierce intelligence and great wit and great charm.
Is she, do you think, the outstanding heroine in the Jane Austen canon?
I think she probably is. And Jane Austen herself said, she said, how will I stand it if people don't like Elizabeth? You know, there was a real sense in her own letters that she knew she was creating something quite new and somebody very irresistible. And there's another letter when she says to her niece, she says, as long as you like Lizzie and Darcy, I don't care if you hate all the rest of the characters. So it seems to me that she, you know, she really felt strongly towards Elizabeth in a way that we still do. And I suppose with all of her characters, you feel like they're flesh and blood. You feel like you know them. And that's part of what she's doing, which is so clever. It's her realism, which, makes them flesh and blood. They sort of bounce off the page.
Well, you said yourself she's not supposed to be particularly beautiful. She is supposed to be incredibly smart and witty, and she's kind of, you know, spunky. She gives it back to people who mess with her. She's a very spirited heroine. But is that, do you think all of these readings on her, should we take away from that she is a feminist and that these are, in some respect, feminist books?
I think they are, and I think the real clue to that is when Elizabeth says to Mr. Collins, I prefer you to think of me as a rational creature. And it seems to me when she says that, and it's a wonderful moment, I think a hilarious moment, when Mr. Collins makes this awful marriage proposal, and he fully expects Elizabeth to say yes, and she says no, and he says, oh, come on, you're just saying that to, you know, to increase your allure, you know. And she says, no, I really don't want to marry him. And he says, this is what fine women do, they mess us around. And she says, no, you know, don't think of me like that, think of me as a rational creature who can make my own mind up. And that's a direct sort of echo of what the great feminist Mary Wollstonecraft was saying in her political tracts. Women are rational creatures. We have reason. We have brains. We can think for ourselves. We're not dolls. We're not puppets. So she definitely is. And you know, she's bold. I mean, she turns down Mr. Collins, and she turns down Mr. Darcy's first proposal because she's not in love with him. And it's despite the fact that Darcy's wealthy and, you know, he's got this amazing house. Let's not forget, she does turn him down. You know, it's quite extraordinary that she does that first time around. Of course, she accepts his proposal later on in the novel.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there is this feminist underpinning, but these novels and Pride and Prejudice have gotten, maybe not criticized, but it's been observed that they're fluffy. They're about romance and girls looking for husbands. And sometimes they can be dismissed by that same token.
Exactly. And they're really not fluffy. And, you know, she's an anti-romanticist in many ways, Jane Austen. I mean, she's going against lots of other novels at the time where you have these perfectly beautiful heroines. And she herself said, pictures of perfection make me sick and wicked. She didn't want to write about perfect heroines. And she often says, look, you know, in her novels like Sense and Sensibility, you see these handsome people like Willoughby Raikes. And in fact, they turn out to be heartbreakers. And she's saying, you know, often the people that are best for you are people that you know. It might be a brotherly figure. So she's very anti-romanticism. And she's just too dark, too clever. The social satire is too sharp to be categorized. And so people do get her wrong. And I think sometimes people who just see the DVDs perhaps don't really fully see how acerbic and how caustic she is and how much she knows those constraints of society. She knows that women are put under these terrible positions. So when Charlotte Lucas says to Elizabeth, look, I have to marry Mr. Collins because I'm not particularly pretty. I'm quite plain. I don't have any money. I know what the contract is. We both know what we're getting. And Elizabeth rejects that. But Jane Austen doesn't reject. She's saying, look, this is what some women need to do in order to get to get a financial stability.
Well, so I know that there's a lot more there, and you know that there's a lot more there. But, I mean, do men read Jane Austen? Do they get that and respect her?
You know, I think they do, actually. And my husband, for one, absolutely adores Jane Austen. And I do. I know many men who do. And it's quite interesting because, particularly in the academic world, the men have always loved her. Like, great American critics like Lionel Trilling adored her. And actually, they fall in love with her, male critics. They really fall in love with her. She's always been so revered by the literary establishment. And yet, she also appeals to the popular reader. And I think that's what makes her so special, is that she's respected in terms of literature and in the canon of literature, but also, as I say, she's got this wonderful sort of popular appeal.
Do you think that the issues that she writes about, say in Pride and Prejudice, about, you know, being true to your own heart and other themes like that. Are they still relevant today, or is this more? Is her writing more of sort of a snapshot, a beautiful, perfect snapshot of an era that's passed? Do we love it because it captures history, or do we love it because it's still relevant?
Do you know, I think it's a bit of each, really. I think we do love that sense of the hierarchy and the safeness of that world where everybody, in a way, did sort of know their place within reason. And I think there is a sort of heritage, frocks and smocks, love of the past. And I think that's okay. You know, people sort of criticise sort of Janeites, as they're called, for, you know, oh, it's all heritage and it's all whimsy. But, what's wrong with that? I mean, soldiers in the First World War, recovering from shell shock, were told to read Jane Austen by their doctors.
Why was that?
To heal them, to make them smile, to make them feel safe, to make them think about England. There's a whole sort of book to be written about why male soldiers read Jane Austen for comfort, but I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And I think people do want to read about the past, but also those things are still, they are relevant. I mean, there's a newspaper story today in England where a stately home it has gone to a male heir because the man had 8 daughters and none of his daughters can inherit it. And it made me smile. I thought, my goodness, when Jane Austen's writing this novel about 5 Bennet sisters, who none of whom can inherit the house because it's entailed onto a male heir. We think of that as a really old-fashioned thing, but in fact, here we are today in the same stories, are here. And it's quite prescient as well. I mean, the talk about Catherine Middleton, you know, the male heir, will we have to change the succession? And these are things that Jane Austen was sort of concerned about. What happens if you just have daughters? But I think the great thing about the novels is the themes are universal. You know, it is about love. It's about what you said, actually coming to understand yourself, that all the heroines, they undergo a journey, a transformation. They learn about themselves. They grow up in the course of the novel. And so all of those things, I think, are relevant to today. And that's why I think people love reading the novels today.
Well, these are novels, as you said, about marriage and lots of other different social aspects as well. This particular novel, Pride and Prejudice, that we're celebrating that its 200th birthday, is about the Bennet family, who has these 5 daughters and not a lot of money, and the poor head of the household, Mr. Bennet, has to marry off these daughters, and their prospects are not all so great. But in general, there are a lot of happy endings in Jane Austen, and you wonder if that aspect of it is something that takes away a little bit from their seriousness.
Well, I think it's important to remember that she is writing comedies, essentially. The romantic comedies is one way of putting it. And I think in terms of the genre, she's got to have her happy ending. That's the convention. It's like Shakespeare comedy. You end with a marriage. You end with unity. There might be a few unhappy people, but that's life. There's a moment in Jane Austen when she reads a novel where the heroine and hero don't have happy endings. She gets quite cross in this letter, and she says, that's not the genre is. This is how you should. So she's working within the confines of that genre, and it must end with the wedding, and you don't see what goes on sort of after the wedding. But it's what she does within that. I mean, she's essentially writing these wonderful, and they are comedies, and sometimes people forget how funny they are, you know. So I don't think she particularly wants to end with a tragedy, although for some people, it does end with tragedy. I mean, Maria Bertram in Mansfield Park, who's one of the main characters, elopes, and then she's thrown out of society, and she ends her days with the awful Mrs. Norris. So there are people who come to sort of sticky ends in the novels. It's not perfect, but I think she's very much working in that genre.
So these are essentially romantic comedies.
I think they are. I think that's what she's working. I mean, the other thing to remember is the novel is a new form when she's writing it, and it's not terribly respected. So she is working within the genre of, you like, say, the courtship novel, romantic comedy. But she is doing something very different with it, and she's trying to make it respectable because it has a bad reputation. And she's bringing realism to the novel because many of other contemporary novels, they're not terribly realistic. All sorts of odd, fantastic things happen. And Jane Austen is writing what they called true to life at the time, natural, probable fiction. And in a sense, that was kind of, it was really pioneering because it was so ordinary. And it was people like Walter Scott who reviewed her, who said, this woman's doing something that no one else is doing. She's writing about people as though they are real and about, you know, they're not fantastic. We don't have huge happenings. They're quite sort of semi-ordinary. But that in itself was, at the time, really pioneering. And also, she's bringing respectability to this genre that's really frowned upon.
Well, this hour we are celebrating the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's celebrated novel Pride and Prejudice, and wondering what you think. Why do you think Jane Austen still matters so much today to so many people, and why have her works gone on to inspire remakes and, you know, twists, modern-day twists like Bridget Jones' Diary? What do you find in Jane Austen that's fascinating and stays with you, and who are your favorite characters? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert as we talk with Paula Byrne on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Veronica Rickert with you today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn, and join us today at noon as we celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in words and music. It's Wisconsin's 33rd annual tribute at the State Capitol Rotunda in Madison with your host, Jonathan Overby. You can listen right here or online at WPR.org. That's the 33rd annual tribute to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. live from the State Capitol today at noon here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we're talking Jane Austen this hour, just celebrating the 200th anniversary of the novel Pride and Prejudice, largely considered her finest work, with our guest Paula Byrne, who's the author of The Real Jane Austen, A Life in Small Things. And Paula, one thing we haven't talked about is sort of Jane herself. What was she like? How did she come to have such inner knowledge of the workings of courtship and the self, really?
Well, I think she came from a very large, lively, clever family. So she was one of eight children, although one of her brothers was mentally impaired and was sent to live away from the home. She had six brothers and one sister living with her. And they were clever, great readers. They put on amateur theatricals at home. They started literary magazines. And it was a family where wit was prized very heavily. So you had to fight, you know, she was the second youngest. She had to be quite a feisty person, I think, to have got a word in edgeways. But she was greatly supported and encouraged by this large family. And most importantly, she was a great novel reader. She loved reading novels.
But she never got married, right?
She never got married. She had lots of suitors. And one of the things I discovered in my biography was just how many suitors she had and really how close she came to marriage. And again, it's one of these great sort of myths about Jane Austen. Oh, she was a spinster and what happened? And she had this great love who was sent away. And it seems to me that she did have plenty of suitors. She was very attractive to men. There's no question about that. But I think her desire to be a writer was more important than her desire to be married.
So she apparently thought that if she got married, it would all be about keeping up the household and planning the meals and all of that, child-rearing instead of writing?
Exactly, exactly so. And, you know, she didn't envy. She looked around her and she saw what lots of her friends, her female friends, were going through. And she it wasn't for her. I mean, I really do believe this. And there are letters when she says, oh, so-and-so, she's having her 13th child, poor animal. And then she writes to her niece and says, don't have children too early because you'll be worn out by the time you're 30. You know, take your time. Don't get married too soon. And there's no sense of sort of envy. You know, I think she was really happy with her lot. I think she had a little bit of a phobia about childbirth. Two of her sister-in-law died in childbed, as they called it then. And I think she was, you could not be aware of the dangers. I mean, it was a risky business. So I think she was quite happy with her lot, provided she became a published writer. I don't think she envied the women around her.
And I gather she kind of had, at some points, kind of a naughty sense of humor, didn't she? She was a little ribald.
Oh, she was. And she could be crude. She makes very risque jokes. Even as a young child, she wrote these wonderful early sketches, and she makes very risky jokes, which I think, again, is because she's growing up with boys, and she knows what makes boys laugh. So it is quite racy, some of it. It is quite naughty humour. These were stories written for the family, not meant for public consumption. So you really get the sense of the ribald Jane Austen. And she could be very caustic. She could be quite cruel. You know, she was cruel. Her wit was cruel. She was no prude. I mean, you know, the Victorians tried to pretend that she was this, you know, demure, coy person. She wasn't like that at all. She was a typical Georgian girl, and you know, anything could be joked about. Anything could be made fun of. And I think that's really important to remember with Jane Austen.
She sounds like fun. Don't you wish you had the chance to meet her?
Oh, I do. And, you know, just some of the letters, I mean, they're just so wonderful. And she makes you laugh out loud. You know, she just can't help being funny. You know, I'd love to imagine. And yet, in fact, we're told by one of her brothers that she was so shy that she came across in public as very haughty because she was so desperately shy. But once you got to know her, once she was in the family scenario, she would just be so witty and so funny, and she would make everyone laugh, and she'd make herself laugh. She'd laugh at her own jokes. Occasionally she'd laugh out loud and then run upstairs and write something down. So I do see her as this, she was shy, but just this great love of life. And like Elizabeth Bennet loves absurdity. She loves to laugh at things that are pompous and absurd. And I think Jane Austen's very like that.
Well, let's go to our phone lines now. We have Dolores on the line from Kenosha. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, good morning.
Morning.
I love Jane Austen. And even if you know, people generally look at them and say, oh, these are very nice, light books. I think you could teach an entire semester's course in human interpersonal relationships, probably at the high school level, and not just discussing, oh, what the main couple goes through, but who do they consider amongst the, you know, you have several older couples that have been together for years. Why are they successful? Why do some of these other characters, why are they not successful? Why, there's a whole realm of things that you can look at and say, even if you place it within the time that she's writing about, I think so much of this goes beyond that.
Right, that it keeps on resonating today, that we could, sounds like Dolores is saying that we could analyze the characters here and learn a bit.
I really agree, Dolores, and I teach at Oxford University and I teach courses on Jane Austen. And you know, we never, ever never run out of things to say. And I think you make a really important point that I think one of the themes that she's really interested in is parents and children. Because very often the heroines don't have terribly good parental figures. You know, they've got to make their own mistakes. They've got to make their own way. And if you look at, say, Mr. and Mrs. Bennet, for instance, he marries her because she was pretty, and he lives to regret that. And there aren't many older married couples in Jane Austen's novels that one would look to and say, "Well, that's a really happy marriage."
I think the one I do like her aunt and uncle
in Pride and Prejudice.
In Pride and Prejudice, I do like them because they basically. It's like they've been together, they work things out, they have all these kids. I remember the first time I saw the film and I thought, oh my God, how could you travel with all these people in one coach? But yeah, and they all get out and they're all smiling and everything, and it just, just kind of the way their family worked. And I think the name just escapes me, like her final books.
Persuasion or?
Persuasion, yes. The Admiral and his wife.
Oh, lovely. Really? Yes. Yeah.
They're just such a wonderful couple, and they don't push their ideas on anyone, but they've been there. They've seen things. They've made adjustments. And when you talk about parents, when you get her father, where the captain comes and at the very end and says, you know, I wish to marry your daughter. And he goes, Anne, whatever for. because he is such a shallow person. But there's just so much of that throughout all of her books.
Oh, that, it's so true. And you know, as I say, there aren't many very happily older married couples, but you've picked Admiral and Mrs. Croft. You just know it's a beautiful depiction of a marriage. And she's been on board his ship. She's had deprivations and privations, and they've gone through a lot together. You know, Jane Austen's writing at the time of the Napoleonic Wars and the French Revolutionary Wars, and Mrs. Croft is seeing action. You know, she's a tough woman. And she says to her husband, "I hate to hear you talking as if women were all fine ladies instead of rational creatures. We none of us expect to be in smooth waters all our days." And you just, she's such a wonderful character, Mrs. Croft. She's so feisty, but I completely agree with you. That is a very good and happy marriage. But maybe it's because they are having these adventures together. She's not stuck at home having 13 children.
13 children is a lot of children, yeah. Okay, Dolores, thank you so much for that call. And let's go to Deborah next in Waukegan, Illinois. Hey, Deborah.
Hi. You know, I was going to say the Admirable Mrs. Croft. And I think, you know, the point I wanted to make is I think one of the reasons that the novels end happily, by and large, is that Jane Austen is studying what it takes to make a happy, good life. She's really a major inquiry into that. And then, as the previous caller was saying, then you see all the shades of that. You know, you see people lined up around that. I mean, for example, I was thinking of the horrible brother's wife in Sense and Sensibility. She doesn't get punished. You never hear that bad things happen there. But you think, oh, my goodness, how manipulative she is. How she's, you know, she's the one who talks her husband out of giving anything to the girls. You know, so you just really get this is a horrible woman who's pussy-whipping her husband, you know, into doing bad things. And I mean, I think there's really, as the previous caller said, I think there's a tremendous amount to learn, because I don't think she's giving pat moral lessons. I think she's a true novelist, like Tolstoy, in that she is studying human nature very genuinely and authentically through her characters, and many of her characters say things in a way that couldn't be said otherwise. You know, there's a point made there that you could not make just by writing a dull sentence about how a human being should be.
I think that's so right, and I think you're right that Fanny Dashwood, who's the horrible sister-in-law, she is one of Jane Austen's great monsters, really. She manages to disinherit the sisters in one conversation. It's a tour de force, you know, and that it's a whole chapter is a conversation saying, oh, I don't think you should give them that much, and in the end they get a few pheasants and a bit of fish from the river. So she's a great comic monster, and I think you're absolutely right. It's just that it's that knowledge of human nature, and you know, if you're a female, if you're a male, she doesn't discriminate. There's good and bad in everyone, and I think in a way, Fanny Dashwood, she slightly gets a comeuppance, because the last thing she wants is for Eleanor to marry her brother, and Eleanor does get him in the end. Slightly gets it come up, and having Eleanor as a sister-in-law, I think, might be is really interesting. I think, even though she's already her sister-in-law, of course, because she's married to her half brother, it's quite incestuous, isn't it?
I guess it is. When you think about it, there's a lot. The relationships are very tangled, and there's so much intrigue in these novels, and it's kind of worthy of a soap opera, but it's so much better. Well, we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of Pride and Prejudice this hour. Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. I'm Veronica Rickard, in for Kathleen Dunn this week. And we want to know what you think about Jane Austen. If you've read her, what do you think sets her apart? Why do we keep going back and rereading her? And why does her work continue to inspire so much other literary effort and film effort, as we've seen? And if you haven't read Jane Austen, maybe you'd like a suggestion about where to start. We can answer that question as well. And we do have a open line for you right now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send your email to talk@wpr.org. And we do have this from Judith in Green Bay, who emails, "Jane Austen's characters are so relatable. Her heroine isn't perfect. Elizabeth and her sisters are full of personalities that are like people we know." And they are there, as other callers, Deborah and Dolores, have mentioned, that these are fully fleshed out human beings. They really do come with foibles, even though they get their happy endings. I mean, they've got quirks in their personalities. It's that part of why they're so relatable.
Oh, I think so. I think that's absolutely right. As I said earlier, that Jane Austen said pictures of perfection make me sick and wicked. She didn't want to write about perfect heroines because she felt that would be unrealistic. And think about a character like Lydia Bennet. I mean, I rather love Lydia. I mean, she's 15. She's lusty. She doesn't care what anybody thinks of her. She says what she thinks. And she goes off and has this sexual relationship with Wickham before she's married. And she doesn't really seem to care very much whether or not they marry. There's a moment when she says, oh, well, we'll marry at some time. It doesn't really signify. So she really does. I mean, you could almost argue she's a proto-feminist. I mean, she does what she wants on her own terms. But as I say, she really bounces off the page, Lydia. She is so colourful.
And so for people, Paula, who haven't read Jane Austen yet, who haven't been bitten by the Jane bug, what would you recommend? How do they start?
Well, you know what? I often recommend people to start in the order that they were written and published, because I think you see a development in her as well. So Sense and Sensibility is the first published novel, and it's a wonderful, very heartbreaking novel. In some ways, it's one of my favourites because there's just sort of edges to it, there's darkness to it. I mean, you know, that Marianne being quashed in the way that she is, it makes you so uncomfortable. She has this cry of anguish in the middle of the book, and she's so heartbroken. And I probably would start with that, or start with Pride and Prejudice. I mean, it's great to start with. In fact, I probably would start with Pride and Prejudice because it is so light and bright and sparkling, and then move on to the later ones and the slightly darker ones, if you like. So that chronologically, it's a good a way as any to start. And you can't go wrong with reading Pride and Prejudice for your first Jane Austen, because it's the wit, the warmth, the humour, the characters. It's so unforgettable. And you'll go back to it over and over again, I believe.
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is that these are, by and large, these are moral novels. They're novels about people learning to behave, people learning to be mature adults, to make wise, rational decisions. But they are moral as well. How do you think that squares away with the marriage plots and that kind of thing?
You know, I think you're absolutely right to bring this up. And let's not forget, as naughty and bold as Jane Austen was, she was a parson's daughter, and I think she had a deep Christian faith that was a very private faith. But I think the moral element's really important to her. And there's a moment when Elizabeth Bennet says, wisdom is better than wit. And wisdom is better than wit. And we do need to learn to be wise. And also, I think sometimes we need to learn to be kind to each other. And I think, for instance, Emma is about kindness, the importance of being kind to people, and particularly vulnerable women, people like Miss Bates, vulnerable, needy women. And so I think kindness is important. And just also how Jane Austen's very good on how people can make other people's lives in misery. I mean, Lady Catherine de Bourgh in Pride and Prejudice is a bully, and she tries to bully Elizabeth, and Elizabeth stands up to her in this marvellous confrontation where she absolutely refuses to let this powerful woman who bullies everyone. She bullies Mr. Collins, she bullies her, she tries to bully her nephew, Mr. Darcy, she tries to bully Elizabeth, and Elizabeth simply won't be bullied. So I think that moral element is really important.
I mean, you could read them. There's obviously so much there, like we've been talking about, but you could read these today as, you know, primers in character development for young people.
I think so. And I think it's always interesting when you teach it, because I think one of the wonderful things about Elizabeth is it's her capacity to understand that she's been wrong. And I think Jane Austen is very interested in how we can improve as human beings, how we can get to be better human beings. So when Elizabeth realizes her folly and she says, I never knew, till this moment, I never knew myself. She's got it wrong. She's got Darcy wrong. She's got Wickham wrong. She's judged people by first impressions. But it's what she does afterwards. It's how she behaves afterwards. And it's that sense that she said, I thought I knew. I thought I was smart. I thought I was intact. But actually, I've got this wrong. And it's that wonderful capacity to realize that sometimes we do get things wrong and we don't get things right. But we can change. We can grow. We can become better human beings. And I think there is something to learn from that, that we can be less selfish. We can listen to people. You know, there are sort of wonderful moral lessons to be drawn about just living in our society, making our lives better by learning to live with other people. And that doesn't mean that you have to take all sorts of, you know, bullying. You don't take, you know, people like Mrs. Norris and Lady Catherine, they're horrible bullies, and I don't think they have much capacity to change. But I think a heroine's do. And also Mr. Darcy does, you see. That's what's so wonderful about Mr. Darcy is he changes through, he's transformed by love. His pride is humbled and is mortified, and he changes and he just becomes a nicer person.
So maybe we should be giving the Jane Austen box set to our kids when they turn 13.
I think we should, but I think you can read it too young. I mean, I think we mustn't forget she's an ironist. So an irony is quite difficult to explain, to understand. Mm. And I think you can be a bit too young for Jane Austen. I think as you get older, you come to appreciate it more and more, and you see those layers, and you start to understand the irony, and you start to understand what she's doing with the narrative voice, how she flatters the reader. You know, you read Jane Austen and you think, it's just me and you in the room together. There's something she does that's really technical and really clever. But I think younger people can read it for the stories, and as you say, for the morals, for that idea of learning to be better people. But I think she's someone that you really learn to appreciate as you get older, certainly for me.
Okay, well, let's go to one more caller. Sam joins us from Milwaukee. Hey, Sam.
Oh, hi. I absolutely love Jane Austen. I watch Pride and Prejudice quite often. I also have Persuasion, Becoming Jane Austen, Sensibility. I think my love of Jane Austen is, simply put, I'm in love with romance. And I've noticed in her movies that, and I understand her movies reflect the social context of that time and how, you know, romance, you know, gradually progressed between a man and woman. But I wish that was the same way now. I think our society, you know, so much is expected right away, you know, and in that period, or at least based on her movies, you know, romance, you know, took time. It took time, and people understood that. Not much was expected the first date. You know, people understood that romance, I don't know, it just took time. And I'm a little nervous here, but I can appreciate that about her movies. And I guess I just wish that people thought that way a lot more now when it came to romance and how it's a progression. It's not instantaneous. It's not something that you should expect to happen right away, and you should be willing to put that time into it. And I kind of get that sense when I watch her movies.
Right, so, yeah, and people also fell in love with because who the other person really was and not how they appeared.
I think you make a really important point, and I remember seeing a Jane Austen movie when I was living in D.C. in America, and I remember hearing a man leave, and he said, wow, when he just touched her and took her into the carriage, it was the sexiest thing I'd ever seen. And all he was doing was lifting her into a carriage. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this man gets it. He just gets it. And I completely agree with your caller that it's so subtle and understated. And often it's very nonverbal. It's a look or a touch, or it's exquisite and slow burning. And it is about, you know, you get to know each other, and you know, Darcy and Elizabeth, they don't like each other at first. And it's a long, slow process. And yet, by the end of it feels so romantic and so true and so real. I mean, I do really agree with your caller.
So do you think that's part of it, this sort of nostalgia for a different era of romance that is long gone?
I do. I think that comes into it because I say it's so, everything now is just seems so sort of in your face and so fast and about sort of sexual gratification, and whereas this, it's almost like a dance. It's a lovely dance of verbal sparring and getting to know each other and getting to know each other's families and having a dance. And even when they dance, they're hardly touching, but there seems to me to be great sort of chemistry, particularly between, say, Darcy and Elizabeth, and yet they're never alone. They're always in a room with other people. It's very rare they're actually ever alone. And you know, that just doesn't happen today. That sense of, for women, you need to be chaperoned, or you meet in a ballroom, which is a very public place. So it's very hard for women, and women are under such social constraints of behaviour and decorum. Not that that stops Lydia Bennett.
I agree. I think we do need more dancing in ballrooms, don't you? We're talking this hour with Paula Byrne, the author of The Real Jane Austen, A Life in Small Things, as we celebrate the 200th birthday of the novel Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. And wondering what you think. What is your favorite Jane Austen book? Or maybe you've liked one of the recent movies that have sort of spun off of Jane Austen. We've seen the Bridget Jones books and movies. The movie Clueless, starring Alicia Silverstone, was a take on one of Jane Austen's novels. And do you think they still apply today? Do you still reread them and think that you really get it and she was really on to something? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can always send your email instead to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And coming up at 10 o'clock today, we have Larry Mueller in, and he's talking about meat. The majority of us eat it, but do we know how to choose the right cut and how to prepare it? Well, after 11 o'clock, Larry talks to a self-proclaimed meat guru about his new book. It's called The Great Meat Cookbook, Everything You Need to Know to Buy and Cook Today's Meat. I'm Veronica Rickert, and I'm in today for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we revel this hour in all things Jane Austen, our excuse is the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's celebrated novel Pride and Prejudice, and we're joined by Paula Byrne, who is the author of the book The Real Jane Austen, A Life in Small Things, and she also teaches Austen at Oxford University. And we go next to Christina, who's joining us on the line from Racine. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
Hey, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to talk about how much I really, really love Jane Austen and her stories. I'm sorry, I have a little bit of bronchial problems, but one summer I did pay my niece and her girlfriend to read at least one of Jane Austen's novels, and they did. And it's been a delight to refer back to that time period, especially as my niece grew older. She had a boyfriend who heard a lot about Jane Austen and her characters. And there was a standardized test he took in college, and he was probably the only male, but maybe the only person in that class to know one of Jane Austen's characters. It was wonderful, just hysterical when they told me about all of that. So, I love the movie Persuasion, especially the last part as it was indicated or quoted about the marriage, why there would be the marriage to Anne, and whatever for. That is one of my favorite lines from any of her movies. And Mr. Redgrave did such a beautiful job playing that character. It was great. And her sister, I think that was probably, to me, one of her best movies, although I watch Pride and Prejudice with Keira Knightley all the time. At least once a month, I watch that. However,
really? Once a month?
Probably. I mean, it's on television, or I'm home alone, and I can just, do things and watch that, and it's just a really good entertainment story for me. But also, I do have the very first public television show of Pride and Prejudice. I believe it was on Masterpiece Theater,
right?
Back in the 70s, and I bought that, and it's wonderful because you can hear the footsteps on the wood floor because it was in the primitive old days of public television. I still love the characters, the wonderful actors and actresses from that time period. But I think for me, as a point of literature and why this applies, this story applies, Jane Austen wrote of the days in England. Herman Melville wrote of the days in early America. And Tolstoy wrote wonderful stories about his time in Russia. And they all are the same intrigue with relationships, but it's a description of their country and their culture. And it's absolutely marvelous to, I would love to teach a course of all three, comparative literature, because they all apply equally.
I agree. And I really agree that the Persuasion that you talk about with Colin Redgrave is one of the very best. I thought that was absolutely superb. I thought all of the character, and the character Amanda Roos, who played Anne, was just perfect. And I thought the way that she blossomed and she regained her bloom, it was just so beautifully done, so understated and so moving. I completely agree with you.
And I love your enthusiasm, Christina, that you watch Pride and Prejudice every month. Sounds like she's got a real love affair going with Jane there. Well, thank you so much for that call. And we go next to Marilyn joining us from Cleveland. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. I just wanted to briefly say that after 9/11, I went back and reread all of Jane Austen because her world was so remote from the horrors that we were experiencing. I find her soothing to read.
Yeah, I can see that. That is a wonderful idea, reading Austen for comfort. What do you think about that, Paula?
Do you know, I've heard so many people make the same point. And I really have such great sort of sympathy for that notion and understanding, because we all long to hearken back to an age where, as you say, we don't have those horrors and where there was safeness. But at the same time, Jane Austen was living in a world where she was at war, her country was at war, and it was quite a frightening place for her too. And you know, particularly in Pride and Prejudice, you know, the presence of the militia, they are there to protect people from French invasion, which British people really felt it was a very real worry. Jane Austen had two brothers in the Navy and one brother in the militia herself. So she was very aware of those dangers. But I can understand what your call is saying, that need to sort of go back and to a different age where, as I say, there's a sort of order there, there's a gentility, there's good manners, there's a feeling of safeness. And I think, as I was saying to you earlier, Veronica, wounded soldiers from the First World War were encouraged to read Jane Austen because they'd seen so much trauma. And I think that's just so interesting that doctors prescribe, like medicine, reading Jane Austen's novels to soothe troubled nerves.
Oh, that's so interesting. So obviously back in those days, she was not considered woman's writing. She was just considered good and soothing writing.
Exactly. And as you say, it's so fascinating because we think of it as sort of women's fiction and written for and about women. But in fact, you know, I don't think that's true at all. And particularly, as I say, this idea of soldiers with post-traumatic stress syndrome reading Jane Austen, there's something really, I think, very beautiful about that.
There is. I bet she'd like knowing that.
I think she would.
She did.
I think she absolutely would.
All right. We go to James. James is calling us from Stevens Point. Hi there.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi there. I have one of my favorite quotes that I wrote down years ago, and I actually found it. And it is Austen's Defense of Fiction from Northanger Abbey.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll read it briefly.
Okay.
It is only a novel. In short, only some work in which the greatest powers of the mind are displayed, in which the most thorough knowledge of human nature, the happiest delineation of its varieties, the liveliest effusions of wit and humor are conveyed to the world in the best chosen language.
Hooray! I love that quote. I love that quote. I have that quote pasted up on my wall.
Yeah, I wrote it down in my
It's quote. So important. It's the most wonderful, passionate defense of the novel. And I don't think anyone else has described the novel so powerfully and vividly as that. I'm so glad you read that. It's so important, that quote.
Oh, well, thank you so much, James. That's lovely to hear. And Paula, do you have a favorite Jane Austen quote that you turn to?
I think the one I said before about irrational, I love that quote from Mrs. Croft when she says, don't talk as women were fine ladies instead of rational creatures. We none of us expect to be in smooth water all our days. And I love that because women aren't always in smooth waters and we do want to be rational creatures and we don't want to be fine ladies. And I think that's lovely. But I think there's a quote for almost every mood you're in with Jane Austen. You could go to the letters any time. You could go to the novels any time, and you can find the right quote to suit the right purpose. I mean, you can read these novels again and again and again. And there are far too many. There are far too many.
We haven't talked yet, and we've only got about less than a minute left. But what have you thought, as a Jane Austen scholar and devotee? What have you thought about these retakes on her, like Bridget Jones' Diary?
Oh, I love it. I love it all. And I think it's, you know, I don't think people should be snobbish. snobbish about it. I think the DVDs, the films are great, and I think they're gateways into the novels. And I think if young people are watching Keira Knightley and it brings them to the novel later on, fantastic. Why not? I mean, I just don't see what the problem is. I love Bridget Jones's Diary. I loved Clueless. I think Clueless was absolutely in the spirit of Jane Austen. I think of all of the DVDs, I think Jane Austen would have loved Clueless best.
Well, this is fabulous. I think we're all going to be heading out and reading some Austen these next few days. Thank you, Paula, so much for joining us. It's been fun.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Paula Byrne, the author of The Real Jane Austen, A Life in Small Things. Paula also teaches Austen at Oxford University. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who produced this hour's program. And thank you to Rob Ferret for answering your phone calls and doing on-air production this hour. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in all this week for Kathleen Dunn. And don't forget, if you want to keep up with what's going on the Kathleen Dunn program, you can check out her Facebook page. Keep up there. Leave your comments. You'll find it at The Kathleen Dunn Show on Facebook. I'm Veronica Rickard on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.